Welcome to our podcast series, Coffee with the Council. I'm Alicia Malone, Senior Manager of Public Relations for the PCI Security Standards Council. Today, I am so excited to bring you a sneak peek interview with PCI SSC's community meeting keynote speaker, Jenny Radcliffe. Jenny is a world-renowned social engineer hired to bypass security systems through a mixture of psychology and con artistry. A burglar for hire and entertaining educator, she has spent a lifetime talking her way into secure locations, protecting clients from scammers, and leading simulated criminal attacks on organizations of all sizes in order to help secure money, data, and information. I'm delighted to have you join us today, Jenny.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So clearly you have an unusual profession. How did you get started as a professional people hacker?
Oh, so, you know, it's so funny because I get asked this all the time. Obviously, there's no course you can take, right? And there still isn't a course you can take to be a people hacker. And for me, the journey was really a family journey. I mean, where I grew up in the UK, at the time I grew up, was in decline, right? It wasn't a great area. There was a lot of crime and unemployment. Lovely people. And we rise like a phoenix from it. But at the time, there wasn't a lot to do. And I'd had some run-ins with like local bullies and a couple of other things that happened to me. So my family thought that it would be better if I was looked after by my cousins, right? So I had older boys who were cousins, and it was like they were in a big group. Don't be on your own. Go and kind of hang out with them. And they looked after me because my parents worked and did different things. But what they were doing was what we now call urban exploration. And so they were getting into empty derelict buildings all over Liverpool, which is where I'm from, and just looking around like kids do, you know. And when I speak in conferences, I do keynotes all over the world, and there's always someone at the end who comes up to me and says, "We did that." You know, there's a haunted house in the neighborhood. There's an empty place. And we used to do that. And that's kind of the physical infiltration side of things. We were doing that. We got older. The boys went to work in security in some of the bars in the city. And we'd talk about it. You know, we'd say, oh, there was that time we spent the night in the museum, because we did that before there was a movie, right? We spent the night in the museum. And eventually we got asked to do some people with high net worth homes. So they said, well, if you could do that, could you look in our house and tell us how someone could break in? I mean, how could someone get in? But the boys were older and they looked like they were quite tough looking, because they were. But I wasn't. And so the wives and the girlfriends and everything, they talked to me, their families. And the boys also didn't want to write reports. So I'd write these little, kind of like a report. Wasn't really little report and recommend, you know, burglar alarm or better lock or something, which we had a little business that we sold them. And it kind of started like that. But of course they had businesses. So the next thing, it was businesses. And just word of mouth. It wasn't very well known at the time. From word of mouth, we ended up doing that quite a lot. They lost interest. And I had a conventional career doing other things. But by then I had connections that asked me to do that quite a lot of what we now would call a penetration test, physical infiltration. And I did that, but I learned quite early on that it was easier to talk my way in than to break in. And so from a psychological point of view, I never had tech skills. So psychologically, how could I persuade someone, you know, to do it, to let me in, whether it was a receptionist or security guard? I mean, security guards never thought I was dangerous because I look so innocent, Alicia, you know. And so that was how it started. And then over the years, I always did it alongside other jobs, sort of as a sideline. We call it a side hustle these days. But once the internet came online and I started to research, I saw that it was more of a real job, and that particularly in the States, people were doing this and charging for it and admitting that this is what they did, because I would never admit it. Because I thought, if people think I'm a burglar, you know, I didn't think I could make a living from it, really. So, you know, I wouldn't get hired in a normal job if people thought I was a burglar. So, but once I saw that, I eventually sort of came out the closet and said, yeah, I'm a burglar if you want to hire me. But I only rob you if you pay me. That's what I used to say.
So in the payment industry, we focus a lot on technical security and various steps we can take to protect payment data. But the human side of security is just as important in this conversation. What are some security mistakes that we all make?
So there's mistakes we make as businesses, first of all, and then there's mistakes that we make as individuals. And in this area, the two things aren't really that separate. From a business point of view, it's cultural mistakes. And that means that people have to know, first of all, what an attack might look like, what a social engineering attack and approach might look like. So, you know, is this someone contacting me, giving me an emotional story, emotional content? Are they asking me to go out of context, you know, to move money away from the rules or do it very quickly? So the first thing is, you know, we need to make sure people are aware of how these things look, because social engineering is responsible for the majority of security attacks in some way. So we need to educate first. Then they need to know where to report it, right? And that's, and it sounds so simple, but like, how do I, if I get a call or I get an email and I think that this is a phishing email or a social engineering call or a con, who do I talk to and how to quickly resolve it? But then once that's in place, the key thing for an organization is a culture. And the culture has to be something that's not about blame. So we can't blame people for falling for con artistry. We can't blame people for falling for scams, because scammers and hackers, criminal hackers, because we're not all hackers are criminals, but we can't blame people for falling for something that is designed to make them make a bad decision. So it's the culture needs to be, people are more interested in reporting it and not scared of losing their job or being shamed for doing so, that really makes the difference within an organization, along with constant conversations about security. So that's kind of that side of it. And from a personal point of view, and I'm going to speak to this when I do the keynotes, but from a personal point of view, we're so tempted these days, it's so easy to put every aspect of our life online. So, oh, I'm having a great coffee with my friend in this coffee shop I go to every Saturday. Bad idea. It's not bad to share it, but who are you sharing it with? And does it really show what you are doing every week? Right? What's in the post? And you've got to have the mindset of who can see it and what could someone who meant me harm do with this information? And then make a decision of whether or not you want to post it. And if you still want to go ahead, that's your choice. But it's as long as it is a choice. So really, those are the mistakes we make. We overshare, we don't keep up with our cyber hygiene. And in organizations, it's that culture of blame that really are the biggest mistakes, I think.
So how important is an organization's culture in maintaining a secure environment?
Yeah, so I mean, I've sort of spoke to it already, but I think really it's the cultural point that really resonates. And the thing is, it's that constant conversation. It's the idea that the security team can't be the only people who speak about security. We have to hand it back to people. So in the same way that we talk about health and safety, we need to talk about security at team level. And what I always say is we need to know our people as well as we can know them. So we know if there's something gone wrong. We know if they're acting in a, you know, an unusual way, because that sort of stops insider threat and it opens the conversation. They have to become part of the culture of an organization. It needs to be part of everyday conversation. And really, it's the most important thing. It's as important as putting the right tech in place to try and prevent attacks and contain them. Because without that, the humans are always going to be a target, but we can't kind of enlist them as part of the defense. You need to use your culture, the culture of conversation and openness, as part of your defense. But the difficulty is, you can't throw money at that. It takes time and effort and concentration and attention. And those things are harder than just saying, I'll write a check. So it's the most important thing, but it's also one of the hardest things to get right.
The payment industry and cybersecurity roles in general are often male dominated. And I'm wondering if, as a woman, you found it easier or harder to commit a criminal attack simply because of your gender. Can you speak about what you've noticed about the role of women in security?
So again, I'm asked this a lot and you know, questions about this. And, you know, first of all, if someone's good, they're good. right? Gender is neutral in terms of how good you are. But I think, as I said before, I don't look threatening, right? And if I turn up at a company or you know, something, I don't look like someone who's going to commit an attack. I don't look like someone who is dangerous in any way, especially not to a great big security guard, male security guard. And so what I've found is that being a woman, especially now I'm a middle-aged woman, I'm kind of invisible. And in my job, that's superb, because if no one really notices me or suspects me, then I can do all sorts of terrible things. You know, I'm asked to do them. Don't forget, you've got to ask me to rob you and you've got to pay me. But I can do those things without anyone really being suspicious. Whereas I've got, you know, my brothers, my husband, anyone like that, they would draw more attention just because they're big and they could be that kind of stereotype of a criminal or a hacker. So, you know, I often say hackers don't always look like people in black hoodies behind a computer. And so I think from that point of view, I do get away with things just because I don't meet the expectations of what a criminal looks like. Now, that said, the one thing I've said, and I say it in my book a lot, is that female security guards are more suspicious of women. Like, they're less ready to dismiss a woman as not dangerous just because she's a woman. So a lot of the time when we've been caught out, it's been by a female security guard, which is one of the best arguments, and there's a million arguments for really good diversity in the industry, because the more women that you get, the more people from different backgrounds, the better they are at spotting adversaries of all types.
What do you enjoy most about what you do? And what do you find are the biggest challenges?
Oh, God. I mean, I love my job. You know, I mean, if we're talking about the physical infiltration side, it can be very physically demanding. The challenge is it's physically demanding. And I'm older now. I used to be much fitter than I am now. Because once you're inside a building, you're running around all the time. And, you know, I climb in stairs to avoid cameras in elevators and that type of thing. But that side of it can be difficult. You get tired quickly and hot and bothered quickly. I love the job because it's always interesting. It's always exciting. And there's a story behind every job. You know, people say, oh, you tell such great stories and anecdotes. Well, that's because the job is always a story. You know, and at the end of the day, I'm in someone's office and I'm not meant to be there. We're channeling different personas, different characters, really, wherever we go. And that side of it, the inventive, the creative side, is just so much fun. And then I get a lot of satisfaction nowadays in spreading the word about social engineering and increasing awareness about it, because I know that that helps save not just companies, but individuals too. So yeah, both of those.
You are the author of the recently published book, People Hacker, Confessions of a Burglar for Hire. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us a little about the book and what lessons you want readers to take away from it.
So it's a memoir. Right. So it's a biography, an autobiography in some ways, but it's more of a memoir, because I was really conscious when I wrote it that I wanted to write something that people could read quickly and be entertaining. So I want to leave out kind of like the boring bits that you sometimes find in autobiography and just get to the meat of it, which is what people want to know about me is, how did you get to do the job and what's the job like? I did a little bit of background. So the first sort of half of the book is background of how I did it, some of the first jobs and what really the security industry was like in terms of social engineering when I first got into it. And then the second part of the book, I take, you know, 8 or 9 jobs that I've done that show the range of social engineering. So some of them are funny, some of them were dangerous, some of them were lots of details that I didn't know that, you know, you're trying to find out kind of who was behind it and that type of thing. And, that you know, and I put those in. And said in the introduction, you know, there are details sometimes missing. And that's because I don't always know who's hiring me and exactly what's going on, you know, and it can be frustrating. But I think readers have enjoyed trying to fill in the gaps. And I get a lot of messages, emails and social media asking me, well, who was that guy? And did you ever find out what that was about? So I wrote it that way. And what I also tried to do was give an insight into what it was like to be a woman in the industry, to run a small business in a niche area of the industry, and to show the evolution of how security is kind of changing, And also to make some arguments for things like diversity and women in the business and some of the issues that we have with things like plagiarism. And you know, I was just trying to give really a snapshot as well of what I see being at the level I'm at now in my profession. The lessons I want, you know, I want people to be entertained by it, because why wouldn't you be? You know, no one wants a boring book. But I also wanted to show a little bit more about what social engineering really is and how to prevent it. And so when I show what goes into a job and how we plan the job, really what I'm showing, if you're reading it, is, well, look, these are the things that we look for. So maybe you can prevent an attack by a malicious social engineer in the future.
I'm really looking forward to reading your book and also hearing you speak at our community meeting. Since you're on Coffee with the Council, we'd like to ask our guests how they take their coffee, or if you're not a coffee drinker, what do you prefer instead?
Well, let me tell you something. If you'll indulge me, a quick story, and it's in the book, but there was this one time when we needed to buy some time from a Target, and I asked him to get, he asked if he wanted coffee, and we needed him to leave the office. So I said, yeah, get me a, can I have a decaf, please? Now, if you know me, you know that that absolutely isn't me, because death before decaf, right? I take coffee in the morning, strong, a little cream, no sugar. I don't drink coffee after 11, ever. And I very rarely will take anything milky or, you know, sort of fancy. You know, when people go to a coffee shop and they want a half fat, three shots, vanilla, but no, it's got to be good coffee, but it's got to be strong. And really, that's all I do. And I never drink ever, ever, ever that instant coffee that's in hotel rooms. And I can't, I'd rather drink tea. Now, I do drink tea because I'm English, but I drink that only until 4, because obviously I'm not, you know, an animal. And then after that, we don't drink coffee or tea. So there you go. That's a long answer. I suppose some people just go black or white. And that's it. Right?
I like your answer. It's very thorough. There's nothing wrong with that. And I too actually take my coffee the same way. So
there we go.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Coffee with the Council, Jenny. And we look forward to seeing you at the community meetings this fall.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. I'm really looking forward to meeting you all.
You can catch Jenny as the keynote speaker at PCISSC's North America Community Meeting in Portland, Oregon, September 12th to the 14th, and at PCISSC's Europe Community Meeting in Dublin, Ireland, October 24th to the 26th. Registration is now open on our website, and we hope to see you there.